This is the Chew to Toy broadcast, or should I say podcast. I'm Brother Eric, and this is Incarcerated number 11. And if y'all did not listen to number 10, I listened to it yesterday. It was only 15 minutes long, and it was pretty funny. Let me pull Trey on in. But Trey talked about how nervous he was at one point, and want to check out the end of yesterday's podcast. But Trey, looks like Trey done called in. Let me pull him on there. Trey, are you there?
Man, I'm here, bro.
Man, this is number 11. And, man, I'm going to kind of let you go one or two ways. Man, do you want to get more into keep talking about some of the personal experiences, which could take months? I mean, man, I mean, you had a bunch of situations and different experiences, highs and lows when you was incarcerated. Or do you want to talk more about the way the system works once you get in that predicament?
Well, man, it's your show. I'll go whichever way, you know. I think that definitely two totally different things, man. You know, I believe that, you know, for social reasons and for it to just, you know, provide the political will for some change that needs to take place, it's kind of already begun. You know, I think it's good to talk about that and make people aware. On a more personal note, even for people that are, you know, have a criminal past or know somebody that is, and just for people in general, I think, you know, spiritually and for edification, I think it'd definitely be much more beneficial for folks to hear about, you know, some of the things that went on spiritually and personally, you know. So I hopefully we'll have time to get into a little of both.
But just to be clear, I remember you said you don't believe anybody should be locked up for distributing drugs. Did you say that, or is that how you feel?
No, now that would be a misrepresentation. No, that statement right there, that nobody should be locked up for distributing drugs, I would not say that. I do believe our drug laws need to change. I believe that for us to wage an actual efficient war on drugs as it is, with the intent actually being to decrease the usage of illegal drugs and the negative effects on society, both from the addict point of view and from the criminal and violence perspective, I said that all drugs should be decriminalized in order to reach those intended goals. But the laws being as they are, I'm not saying that everybody should be able to break the law. Nobody should be able to.
Because what I wanted to make clear is that you do own up for your actions as far as breaking the law.
I chose to break. I knew that it was wrong to break the law. Now, do I agree with the law as it is? No, but I believe that unless you're really on some type of conscientious objection tip, you know, for a cause or something, I'm not, you know, a marijuana crusader, so it definitely wasn't that. It was to make some money. You know, that's the bottom line. So, I would definitely say, man, nobody, if you're on the wrong side of the law, you need to get on the right side of the law. You know, that being said, that's on a personal note, but the laws and them being executed the way they are, and even just what they are, I know for sure that they do not help in reaching the intended goal of waging a war on drugs in terms of decreasing violence, crime, and addiction. And so
let me ask you this, and this is just I guess this is just, I'm just trying to figure out your opinion on this, but what do you people say that marijuana is not addictive? Now, some people say it is addictive. What do you believe? Do you believe that even matters, or would you say it isn't addictive?
Well, I don't think it's pertinent to what I'm discussing in terms of decriminalization, but I would err on the side of, I don't believe it's accurate to say that it is not possible for it to be addictive. I just do not believe that. I don't believe that it has to be in all cases, but I definitely believe it has the potential to be addictive. Not necessarily in a chemical dependence, but just mentally. You can become addicted to any behavior or any number of things that don't necessarily have to do with your body demanding that substance. It can be a mental. So I think a lot of people become dependent on the high that it gives them, the relaxation that it gives them, the peace of mind that it might bring them. And that can become a negative thing. So I definitely believe it has the potential to be addictive. I would have to say yes. I don't believe it when people say that. Yeah, I believe it does. Now, whether that's an effect of the actual drug itself in terms of, you know, being addictive along the lines of, like, how cigarettes are chemically addictive, I don't believe you can draw a parallel there. But I definitely believe that marijuana has the potential to be addictive. I do.
Let me ask you this. Let me say this, because I was watching, I think, CSNBC or something like that, and they were doing a documentary on Colorado and on marijuana. And either they didn't show it, but I didn't see much. They didn't really show the real negative effects that is happening in Colorado. People have told me that crime is skyrocketed. They said that there's been more car collisions, but they didn't report it, if that's true. But one thing they did show, and I thought about you guys, they showed a guy who was still dealing illegally.
Mm-hmm.
And he said his business was doing very well. And he said because they're taxing it so much, it's so expensive in those pubs that people come to him for, you know, maybe half the price they would pay at a legal place. And this is what he said, you know, they had him all, he was all wrapped up where you couldn't see his face, and, you know, he was disguising his voice a little bit. He said that he's not worried about being caught. He said the police are not looking for marijuana dealers. They're looking for meth and heroin.
Right.
And I said, well, man, that's what Trey and them believed, you know. Mm-hmm. And yeah, go ahead.
Well, two things I would mention about what you said. The first being just his business and its survival in light of marijuana being legal there. And so I would touch on that first to say that I do think it's a fallacy for people to believe that once you make it legal, it's going to make the illegal market just dry up completely overnight. That's not going to happen. And because it's going to be because of prices. But herein lies the problem all along with marijuana as the government is concerned, is that it's a hard substance to impose a tax on for people who just don't want to do that because you can grow it. It's not really like cigarettes or alcohol or things that take some real ingenuity, time, effort, and a lot of space to create. This is a seed that you can put it, you know what I'm saying, in a room, in your house, and grow your own. So it becomes a challenge for the government to, you know, impose taxes on something like that because unlike a distillery or to produce tobacco, you know, they're going to know if you're in the business of producing this product because it takes quite a bit of infrastructure to make that happen. And so, you know, they're going to pay a tax. So marijuana is a little bit different because you can grow it in your backyard. Who's going to stop it? And so
let me ask you this real quick. If they do legalize it, and let's say they legalize it in Nashville or in Tennessee, and you start having people distribute it legally, do you believe that the people that are still doing it illegally should be arrested and punished?
Well, no, I mean, I believe that, again, you would have to admit that there's a hypocrisy in that. You know, like, you know, it's the same thing with, like, the lottery. Gambling's illegal and it's bad and you should go to prison for it, unless the state does it. Unless they have a lottery. Unless we do it, then it's not bad. And so, you know, it's, you know, if you're just, you have to ask your question, why is this illegal? You know, why? What is your why? And so, you know, we spoke about that a few episodes ago, and I mean, I can tell people what the answer is. It's kind of uncomfortable, but, you know, you have to ask your why. If it's not that this substance or this activity is so bad that it should be banned and nobody should ever do it, then you can't make a case for, well, we as the state, certain people can do it and certain people can't. But I do believe in order to, you know, continue to eradicate, but this is what eventually would happen. To make a long story short, what eventually I believe would happen, just speaking business-wise, is that time for the supply curve, meaning the people that are doing it legally and the suppliers that are supplying them, it would take a while for them to get into business to a point where they're moving so much mass to where people doing it illegally can't compete price-wise. Just like today, like, you know, you're just going to be hard-pressed to go find any basic tool, pencil, pen that you can buy and resell cheaper than Walmart, because they do it on such a massive scale now that you just can't compete with them. And it would take the marijuana industry time to reach that. And during that time,
they're taxing it so much, though. That's the reason why it's so expensive. They're taxing.
And then the taxes are going to have a lot to do with it, because, you know, that, again, the thing with hustling that makes it different than anything else is that you don't pay taxes. And right. So, man, you know, the you know, they would have to. They're going to have to balance that out, and it's going to be some balancing to be done. But like I said, on the business side of it, again, those numbers do matter as far as the tax is concerned. But again, you know, even with taxes, even with, like I said, there's not a thriving illegal whiskey business or wine business or liquor business right now, because the infrastructure is so there and the companies that do it on such a massive scale that you couldn't infiltrate their business at this point and compete with their prices, even with the taxes they pay to the government. And it would eventually get there with marijuana as well, but it would take some time and it would probably be some kinks to work out. But, you know, what I've learned is the most efficient and legal way to do business is always going to eventually win out. That's how businesses survive. So the most efficient way to do it is eventually going to win out. You know, and like I said, the thing about, you got to think about a person who, now that's the other thing about the illegal market, again, is that it's filled with non-business people. And so, but for the people who are business-minded and who really do just want to provide for their family, is it worth continuing to do this illegally and have to risk jail and fees and having all your stuff taken and bond and lawyers and all, or just to set up a shop, pay the government their tax and do it legally? And so it would be some kinks.
But yeah, I guess, but under, if it was your rules though, Trey, that's kind of where I'm getting kind of having conflict, because under your rules, then there wouldn't be no punishment for the guys that did it under the radar or did it illegally.
Well, no, what I'm saying is that it's like any other business. You know, you can start and sell anything, but you have to go through the proper channels, and there's ramifications if you don't. See, decriminalizing it doesn't make it illegal. You know what I'm saying? There's a difference between something being legal and criminalized, where it's a criminal offense. There's a way to violate the law without being a criminal. So I'm not saying, again, you know, I think, again, when we hear the word decriminalized or legal, it sounds like it's synonymous with no regulation whatsoever. And I'm not saying that, but I'm just saying, I do think, just from a moral standpoint, for one person to go to jail, prison, for doing something another guy's doing, just up, it's just the same today. There's, you know, there's an executive, man, I watched a video a while back of some executives back in the 70s. And then some of them recently testifying before Congress about tobacco and how, you know, they were making their case for it not being addictive still. And, I mean, these guys are just rich. I mean, they're filthy rich, but they're viewed as businessmen. But they're the real drug sellers. Like, you know, pharmaceutical companies and these people that market all these drugs and stuff. Because if you actually want to look at the drugs that are doing the most harm in America today, they're the legal ones. They're the painkillers, your Percocets and your Trazodone. It's your stuff that's being sold and prescriptions being written and doctors getting paid to write false prescriptions. It's all kind of stuff, man. So it just depends on how you view it.
I think most people would be afraid to, you know, go on Jefferson Street or go to the, you know, some neighborhood and receive some kind of homemade painkiller or, you know, some things you just don't want to.
Oh, right. That's what I, you know, homemade. So, and, you know, and that's the thing, too, about, you know, that's another thing about the majority of the marijuana market that would take place. Like, take a guy like you who, or me, would you rather drive to, you know, go up the street to Green Hills or next door to your Kroger's and walk in and buy an ounce of weed, or do you want to go to some dude's house, some alley out north and buy it? Now, you're going to have a group of people that don't mind doing that. But by and large, especially if you're going to prosper, you really want the suburban crowd, you know, your moms from out at, you know, Davidson Academy. You want these people that, you know, just want some nice weed to smoke before they go to bed. These are going to be your clients that are really going to make, just like any other business, you want the stable customer that's going to be the cornerstone of your business. It's not, you know, the guy who's on food stamps and using half his rent.
I don't know, man. The guy in Colorado, we're not even a year in for it being legal to be a recreational drug in Colorado or somewhere around there. And he said his business has been thriving. But I believe
it's going to continue to do that, man, for a while. And you got to think also, man, there's, again, we tend to think kind of in black and white terms, but again, legal is not synonymous with no regulation. There are still limits on what you can buy, sell, and possess in Colorado, even recreationally. You can't just do whatever. We can't just walk in and buy a pound if you want to.
Yeah.
And so the distribution of it and how the money's made, I probably couldn't legally do in Colorado what I did here. You see what I'm saying? I don't know that I could do that. And so it's going to take time, man, for them to balance this thing out over time. It's not going to be, you know, you're looking at 5-10 years in, there's going to have to be new legislation that their state's going to have to pass. They're going to be fixing it as they go. It's going to take some time. But I'm not surprised the dude's business is still doing well.
Yeah.
I'm not.
And what I want to hit on, so we don't sound like we're talking, we're just a drug weed show. But I want you to hit on, this is what he said, though, and it tripped me out because this is what I was taught to believe, that the police don't really care about pot. They don't care about policing pot. You know, it's a schedule six drug. You know, it's no worse than a cigarette, you know. And that's
much
what he
better
said. He said they're not looking for weed. They're not looking for marijuana. They're looking for meth and coke. And I said, that's what he thought. That's what we thought. But if they have police officers out there, like the one, or DAs like the one you had, who police for profit, it don't matter what the drug is. See, when you can make $1 million
about any detail, dude,
off a group of people, then it don't matter what it is, because they're not looking to punish people who are selling drugs. They're looking for a profit.
And that's the bottom line.
Talk a little bit more about that, because that's the part that I have an issue with the whole thing, is that they can take 20-some guys and make $1 million off of y'all's case, close to a million. I talked to my father the other day, and he said, yeah, it was about $1 million. They can make $1 million off your case. Now, this is the problem. People who was sending the marijuana into Nashville, they get a lesser punishment than people. I remember one person, she just made a label, and they got 3 felonies, and they took all her stuff away. And her stuff, you know, her house and her car was possessed with her job. She had a really good job.
But she didn't tell me she wasn't a drug dealer, Trey.
Right. No.
But why was her sentence harsher than people who were actually selling drugs?
Well, like you said, you've already said it, man. It's about the money, you know. And there's just no other way to put it. And that's what I would caution that guy who, you know, against better wisdom, went on TV and said that his business is thriving and he's not worried about the police. You know, they're not necessarily looking for, because again, that's what the point I've been trying to get across. The people that police, that do the investigating, the people that are actually going to be the ones to catch you, that actually enforce this war on drugs, they don't care about a drug. They care about the size of the bust as measured in dollars. And so it doesn't really matter what your drug is. What really, and on a personal note, what I found with just some group of people, no matter what the drug is, what they don't like is that you seem to be getting wealthy and living better than them against the law, and you're cheating to do it, is the way they said it. That's what they don't like. They will come after that guy who said that if they find out he's making a couple $100,000 a year and he's doing it illegally. They wouldn't like that. That would make them put the effort and energy into getting him. And also, like you said, it's about the finances of it. They have to go after what's going to give them the most bang, because it costs them money to investigate. The more man hours a task force puts towards something, these are man hours that you're paying these detectives. They got all kind of equipment, and they got, you know, they're tapping phones. They're paying people to man these phones. You know, there's off-duty police officers who come and make extra money manning these phones. And so they have to go after cases that are going to be worth that. And so it's not really relative to necessarily the type of drug, as long as it ends up being worth that. And the way they do it is they're able to use laws to attach all of your possessions to your single offense, like they did the young lady you're talking about. Now, they know good and well that the house that she bought and the car that she drove couldn't have no way be paid for, no matter how much money she was paid. If you estimated at the highest, most ridiculous amount to make a label, they know that she worked a full-time job and made good money, but it doesn't matter. They don't care about that. And so, you know, man, it's that's the way that this war on drugs was designed. It was designed to marginalize a certain group of people. You know,
and look
just
what they did, though, Trey. They said they put you in jail, they take all your stuff, they put these high bonds on you that are absolutely ridiculous. And so and her little bitty role in the case got her locked in jail. She hated being there, so she's under pressure. She wants to get out. So they say, okay, well, if you give us all your stuff, then we'll give you, you know, 9 years probation, and you walk away with 3 felonies. Or she could have fought a case.
I feel like I have to say it over and over again for everybody listening, that me personally, and if you're somebody that know somebody, or you yourself are contemplating making money illegally, I have to advise against it so strongly, just for practical reasons, spiritually, the whole nine yards. Don't break the law. And if you do, you're going to have to, you know, own that choice. And I would say do your due diligence into what law you're breaking and what the ramifications could possibly be. And I have to just say that so that I can say what I'm about to say. This is boldly. Man, I have a problem with the system, man, that decides that this group of people that commit this offense is so worthy of all these umpteens of years in prisons and fines and all your stuff being taken, and you can murder somebody. And if you're just talking about financially, you can, man, the people that orchestrated the whole fall of the American economy, man, they didn't spend a day in jail. And they did it on purpose, knowing what they're. So the way this federal government and the way our laws are legislated, man, it's insane, man. And so, you know, and it's just unfortunately, it is a new Jim Crow. It marginalizes and casts a whole group of people. And it's not necessarily along purely racial lines. It's along social lines as well as racial lines. If you're poor and selling drugs and you don't have a lot of money or parents with a lot of money or that are well-connected, man, it's one of the worst things you can do in America. It's worse than killing somebody. It's worse than defrauding somebody or thousands of people of all of their retirement to sell some weed is worse. And you got to be kidding me.
It's funny you say that because, like I said, I went to go visit my father. And he's in prison. No, he's in jail. And he was talking about how his bond, he has a $500,000 bond.
Yeah.
And he said, I think they got him on like 13 pounds. That's what they have him on. His bond is $500,000. He said back in the back, there's a guy who got caught for armed robbery. And his bond was $80,000. So he's about to
I remember, out. Man, I remember I was in jail. You remember the recent Vanderbilt case where these guys were just found guilty of gang raping this girl at Vanderbilt, which is a heinous and horrible crime. And this girl was unconscious, and they raped her and just made fun of, videotaped it, played pornography, and just real horrible stuff, man. Man, they did this, and I remember being in jail watching it on the news as it broke the news. And you know, at the very end, they'll say they've been arrested and their bond is set at, and it was a few hundred thousand less than my bond.
Wow.
I said, man, this is just insane, man. And so, you know, you have to sit and watch and listen to this stuff, man, over and over again, man, and it's just, you know, again, it's interesting, man. In our country, it's not really what you do. It's who does what that really matters.
Right.
And it just goes across all things in terms of how laws are written and how things are perceived in terms of the justice system, in terms of money, finance, welfare, all of these types of things, man. This country was largely built on marijuana, tobacco, and hash. That's what they ended up building the country on when they came over here. There wasn't no gold, so they built the country and literally survived on the sale of that stuff that they could crop. And now, but of course these were, and again, I'm not against that. I love America, but these were, you know, the fathers of the country, you know, white settlers. And it's just interesting when it becomes a certain group of people that does something that now we have to, I think I sent you the quote of, you know, Nixon's staff and President Nixon, who they were the original drafters of the war on drugs,
yes.
And then Ronald Reagan after it. And, you know, they said, you know, they talked about it. Of course, this is during the Watergate scandal, so they didn't know they were being recorded. But, man, they said, you know, of course, we know we can't criminalize being black or being poor, but we could criminalize what they do. And they said, man, the goal is we have to recognize that the problem is with the blacks, and we have to design a system that deals with that without appearing to. And that's what you have.
And that's the direct quote.
That's the direct quote from Nixon himself and his chief of staff, last name Halderman was what it was. But, man, and these were the people, these are the architects of the drug war. And again, I, you know, it's just, it's so, and again, I get in part of that, you know, I remember in the 80s or reading about and hearing about, you know, later on as I read into this stuff, you know, drugs again, but it goes back to what I'm saying. It goes back to being illegal. You know, they had a big war on drugs, man, in Florida because of all the violence that was going on down there. And
we're about to pick it back up tomorrow, man. We got 40 seconds left, and I don't want it to cut out on people listening online who are listening live. But, man, great show. We'll pick it back up tomorrow, we'll get more into the war on drugs and mass incarceration. This is the Choose to Joy podcast. I'm Brother Eric. That is Brother Trey Gutman. I appreciate you coming on. This is Incarcerated Number 11. 15 seconds, Trey. Any last words?
Man, choose Jesus, man.
I know,
you can avoid it all. Choose the Lord.
No, that's right. All right, man. Thanks for tuning in. God bless you. I love you. And we hope to hear from you tomorrow.